Wes Moore, a native of Baltimore like me, is a Rhodes Scholar, White House Fellow, Afghanistan War Veteran, five-time book author, and for the last 4 years has been running the Robin Hood Foundation. He's stepping down soon and has plans to run for governor of Maryland. On this episode of Peer to Peer, Wes and I discuss the struggle for racial equality in America, his organization's COVID relief work, and his political ambitions. Welcome, Wes, to our show.
It is so good to be with you as always, David. Thank you.
Tell people what the Robin Hood Foundation is, because recently some people think Robin Hood, they think it's stock trading, but that's not what you do, right? You're not in that Robin Hood, right?
That is not what we do. It was amazing. During the whole GameStop episode, I had people who were blowing up my inbox and saying, you know, unblock my trades. And I'm like, I have no idea how to unblock your trades, but I wish you luck with that. But the Robin Hood Foundation is a 32-year-old organization with an exclusive goal of ending poverty. And it was started by Paul Tudor Jones and Peter Borsch and a collection of other people who were actually in the investment business. And they started this foundation where they say, we want to be able to take metrics and best practices and invest in the organizations that we think have the highest probability of being able to end this scourge of poverty. And they started off making about $40,000 worth of investments. Now, 32 years later, we have allocated just shy of $4 billion. Into this work and into this fight. And we fund everything from education to housing, transportation, mental health, and physical health, criminal justice reform, anywhere where poverty is either the cause or the consequence. We will find, fund, build, if necessary, all these mechanisms that we think put us on our better pathway of creating a more equitable society.
So how much money does Robin Hood give away annually, let's say?
Yeah. So over the, you know, when we think about a process of the last year, we ended up raising around $240 million. Just in the past 4 years that I've been the CEO, we've raised over $675 million. But the unique thing about our model is actually this, is that, you know, there are certain foundations that will say, okay, we'll take a portion of our endowment and allocate the portion of our endowment into our grant making. Robin Hood's endowment is essentially zero, right? There's a uniqueness of our model is that every dollar we get in, it will go out within the time period of that next calendar year. And so every year on January 1, it's like press go again. We raise and then we get the money out and the capital out as quickly as possible.
But you have staff. Who pays for the staff, all the administrative costs? That usually in some foundations that can be 5 or 10%.
Absolutely. If not more. But, you know, the other unique mechanism of Robin Hood's model is actually the fact that our board actually covers all operational expenses.
And your focus is New York City. Is that right? Principally?
It is. Even though, since the time that we've come on board, we really, continue to capture the imagination around the idea that while poverty is nowhere near beaten in New York City, poverty is not a New York City issue either, right? So we are a very proud place-based platform and place-based organization. But also, for example, 2 years ago, we launched an initiative called Mobility Labs. And Labs actually is an acronym that stands for Learning and Action Bets. And we have found 7 different communities around the country to really explore the issues of urban, rural, and suburban poverty. And areas that include, my hometown of Baltimore, Maryland, and your hometown of Baltimore, Maryland.
But COVID must have made it more difficult to raise money or to figure out how to give it away and to run the foundation remotely. So how did you do that?
Yeah, I mean, COVID was, COVID in this past year was a remarkable year, David. And there was a lot of uncertainty about what does that mean in terms of how we continue to move at a quick and a fast pace, despite the fact that we weren't going to be together? How do we consider the fact that we knew how damaging this was going to be on our communities and our community partners. As we saw 11 years of job growth go away in 11 weeks. And we knew which communities would be hit hardest by that. It was our communities. And so, I'm so proud of the way that we responded and rebounded. We activated something called the Relief Fund, which was for only the third time in the history's organization that we've activated the Relief Fund. Once was after 9/11. The other was after Hurricane Sandy. And now the third was COVID-19, where we had a few specific focuses. One was supporting the nonprofit sector, which we knew was going to take an extraordinary hit. And these were all the organizations that were doing the social service work in the city and beyond that needed it. And the second piece was emergency cash assistance, just getting cash into people's hands. We knew that from data that we supported and funded and helped build, that over 40%, around 43% of people could not afford a $400 shock with cash. Well, that shock was here, and it was a lot more than $400. So we knew immediately what you had to do was get cash supports into people that needed it most, and specifically people who we saw government intervention was not touching.
Let me ask you, during COVID, many nonprofit organizations have suffered because they would say their donors don't feel as wealthy as they did before. Did your donors say, you know, not right now, I know it's a problem, but I don't make as much money as I used to? Or did you get more money from your donors?
Yeah, we actually saw people who stepped up significantly. And I think there's a couple things, you know, that we learned and really helped to unpackage with all that. One was that the reality was that not everyone was getting financially hurt during this time. That while you did have certain people who did see their incomes decrease or in many cases their incomes go away, you saw some that actually saw their businesses increase and their businesses jump. And part of the challenge that we also continue to see was how this separation and this divide and the wealth divide, how it shows itself. And so you had people who that dynamic and that reality showed itself also in philanthropic giving. The second piece was, I think we saw a measure of human pain and a universality of the human pain that was impossible for people not to respond to.
Let's talk about how you became the head of the Robin Hood Foundation, because you're not, you've worked in New York, but you're from Baltimore, as you mentioned earlier, and you're minding your own business. You're in Baltimore, you're living in Baltimore. How did they come to hear of you? And had you been doing anything like this that would have given you the qualification for them to think that you'd be the right person?
David, I call myself the most accidental foundation head that you could ever possibly imagine, you know, because I had no background in philanthropy. I thought to myself when they first approached me and they were like, you know, we'd like for you to consider being the CEO of Robinhood. And I said, I don't know if that makes sense. And I said, I'm thinking of a bunch of reasons why, but let me give you three. And I said, the first reason is, you know, I live in Baltimore. You know, I'm a Marylander and I don't plan on moving. And so I don't know how I would run a New York based organization when I'm here living in Baltimore. The second piece that I said to them was, I'm enjoying the work that I'm doing here in Maryland. And then the third piece was, I said, you know, I've been critical of philanthropy historically. And in fact, the head of the search committee who became the chair of the board and a good friend said, you know, it's all over the internet. We've seen it. We've done our diligence.
Right. And so, have you realized you're not that persuasive then? You couldn't persuade them not to go after you. But let's talk about your incredible life story. You were born in Baltimore. Yeah. And then your father died when you were young, is that right?
He died when I was about 4 years old. He died in front of me from a rare but a treatable virus.
Your mother said, okay, we're going to move you to New York, or she wanted to move to New York. Did you move to the Bronx then?
Yeah. So she was having a really difficult time with the transition. She became a widow in her 20s with three children that she was going to raise on her own and had a really difficult time with it. And eventually she called up her parents, my grandparents, who lived up in the Bronx. My grandfather was a minister in the South Bronx. My grandmother was a school teacher for 25 years in the South Bronx, both immigrated to this country.
Right.
But their house was barely big enough for them, but they figured out a way to make it big enough for all of us.
Sorry, so you moved up there and you were the perfect child. You never got in trouble. Everything worked out well. Is that right?
In my own mind, yeah. No, I mean, that was a really hard transition for me. By the time I was in seventh grade, I was, I was literally kicked out, and, you know, I found myself hurting people that actually did love me so I could impress people that could care less about me. I mean, I felt first time that I was handcuffed was when I was 11 years old. And so by the time I was 13, after years of threats of sending me away to this school or sending me away to that school or whatever it was, when I was 13, my mom made good on her threats and she sent me to military school.
All right, you went to a military school, and I assume you weren't dying to go to a military school.
Yeah, it wasn't my first choice.
They straighten you out a little bit or something like that?
They did. Well, you know, it took a little while, David. And, you know, I ran away. I think I ran away 5 times in the first 4 days.
All right. So eventually you go to a military college. Is that right?
That's correct.
A junior college?
I did. I graduated from high school, and then I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And honestly, for many people in my life, particularly a lot of the men in my life who were my mentors at that point and the people I admired, they all had one thing in common, and that's they all wore the uniform of this country. And so I joined the Army, and then I went to a military college.
All right. But then you eventually went to Johns Hopkins.
I did.
Is that right?
That's right.
And at Johns Hopkins, you must have done reasonably well because you were elected as a Rhodes Scholar. Now, sometimes people that win Rhodes Scholarships, they go to Oxford, they get a degree or they don't get a degree. Then they come back and say, OK, I'm going to go to Harvard Law School, Yale Law School. I'm going to go into something important like private equity, whatever it might be. Right. What did you decide to do? How come you didn't go to Harvard or Yale Law School or some other great law school? How come you decided to do something that probably not that many Rhodes Scholars were doing?
Well, you know, at first I actually went into, you know, I went to the world of finance, and I was there for a little while working at Deutsche Bank in London, and it was great and it was nice. And then I tell you, David, I remember getting a phone call, and I think I was a brand new analyst working on deals. And it was from my good buddy, at that time, Major Mike Fenzel, who was with the 82nd Airborne Division. And he said something to me that he said, so when are you going to get into the fight? And that was indicting for me, as you know, because I trained. I'm a paratrooper. I'd gone through all my training with my soldiers, and as my soldiers are now deploying to Afghanistan and deploying to Iraq, you know, I was working in high finance, and I literally went back and thought about it and prayed on it. And I went back and called him back up, I think a couple of days later, and said, Mike, I'm in. And so I ended up doing a by name request for me. And I left finance, and I went and I joined up with the 82nd Airborne Division. I went actually down to Fort Benning to go do my training and mobbed up. And then literally probably around 9 months after that conversation that I had in the stairwell of Deutsche Bank with Mike Fenzel, I was getting ready to deploy with the 82nd Airborne to Afghanistan.
All right. So you go to Afghanistan, but did you ask for an office job there, something that you could be kind of not be shot at or something like that?
No, not at all. I was very clear. You know, I went over and I led a group of paratroopers as a special operations officer there, working, you know, information operations, psyops, which is, you know, psychological operations. And we were very much in the field. And, you know, what was interesting is that so much of the conversation at that time, 2005, was Iraq. You know, we had about 150,000 troops in Iraq at the time. In Afghanistan, we only had about 17,000 troops. And so I remember actually when I got deployment orders for Afghanistan, there were a lot of people like, whew, you know, at least you're not going to Iraq. Not knowing the kind of fighting that was going on in Afghanistan at that time. And literally within the first days of Afghanistan, I started seeing firsthand, you know, literally when you see your first firefight, you start seeing just what kind of fighting was going on in Afghanistan.
So how long were you over there?
I was over for a little shy of a year, probably about 10 and a half months.
Okay. Then you came back to the United States?
I did.
And what did you do then?
Then I actually started working back in. So I did a White House fellowship. Mike Fenstein, gentleman, was a former White House fellow. And actually, I came back from a mission one night and he said, I want you to apply for this thing called the White House Fellowship. And he said, you know, it's important for people back in Washington to get a firsthand understanding of the year that you're having right now, so they can actually see what's going on the ground. So I applied for a White House fellowship. I was blessed to receive it, and I had the honor of working under then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and her team, which was just an unbelievable and a life-shifting experience for me to be able to go through that.
Okay, so you, after the White House fellowship, you worked for Condoleezza Rice. Does your mother say, now, can you get a serious job that's a full-time thing, make some money? Is that what you finally decided to do? What did you do?
I did. At that time, my mother was like, all right, slow down and start actually preparing a family. And also, I was newly married now at that point, too. So now you really are starting to think about, all right, what are the things that you want to be able to do? And I started thinking about the things that I was interested in, the skill sets that I'd had. And so I decided that, so maybe I should try to give finance a shot. And then I had the pleasure then of working at Citi. And working for a few years at Citi as an analyst associate, then a vice president, just working on collections of deals.
So you moved to New York.
I then moved to New York. Yes. Yeah. So we were living in Maryland when I got back from Afghanistan and moved to New York for a few years.
Okay. Then when did you move back to Baltimore?
Yeah, I remember having a conversation with another mentor of mine, a person who was running investment banking. Now is running for mayor, Ray McGuire. And I went to him and I said, you know, I think it's time for me to do something different. I just finished actually writing a book called The Other Westmore, which was an important process in time for me just to also be reflective about my own life. And that's when I said I made the decision that I really wanted to leave finance and to go focus on these issues that are really my life's burning issues.
Being a Rhodes Scholar and a White House Fellow isn't enough. You have to write a book as well to make everybody else look bad because you're doing too many things. So tell people now who are watching who the other Westmore was.
Yeah, it was actually during that same time period of the Rhodes Scholarship that it was, in fact, right after I got the Rhodes Scholarship, the Baltimore Sun, which is our hometown paper, wrote this article about this local kid who just got an award and was now getting ready to head off to England on this scholarship. And at the same time, they're writing a whole series of articles about four guys who walked into a jewelry store and attempted to rob the jewelry store. And in this botched jewelry store robbery, ended up murdering an off-duty police officer. And there was a 12-day national manhunt for these four guys. And finally, after 12 days, all four guys were caught. One of the people that was eventually caught was a guy who's we were living in the same area. We were around the same age. We both grew up in single parent households. And his name was also Westmore. And I reached out to him and I wrote him this note. He wrote me a note back. And eventually that singular note turned to dozens of notes. Those dozens of notes turned to dozens of visits. I've now known Wes for almost two decades. But at the same time I was getting ready to head off to England, he was getting ready to start his life sentence in prison. And so The Other Westmore was a book that really evolved from our years of friendship and about these two kids and what ends up happening that causes this split amongst these two kids with similar backgrounds to include names.
So you've now written five books. One of them is about Freddie Gray. Yeah. And this was a person who was taken into a police paddy wagon and en route to the police station, I guess, died and caused riots in Baltimore and so forth. What is your own view now on whether the racial situation in the United States, because of examples like Freddie Gray or George Floyd, have gotten worse than when you were growing up? Or do you see any progress being made?
Yeah, I mean, I see the potential for progress being made. And the potential for progress being made is the fact that we're now understanding and talking about this as not just isolated incidences, but we're understanding the longevity and the lineage of this, that the damage of George Floyd wasn't just the fact that we watched a homicide on camera, but it was the fact that his name gets added to a much longer lineage of names that there's just been no accountability for, right? But it also comes down to the fact that we watch how these acts and we watch how these issues of systemic racism do show themselves in not just policing, whether you're talking about educational attainment, whether you're talking about wealth, whether you're talking about maternal mortality, whether you're talking about basic asset allocation, it's race. And it's impossible to understand this without disaggregating the importance of it. And so I think that the platform for progress is the fact that we are now having a mature and an honest conversation about what is it going to take for us to move into a better space and a place where we're watching it's not just oppressed populations who are demanding justice. And that's the power of this moment.
So many African-American men of your age or older have told me of their own life experiences where they were stopped by police for things that didn't seem appropriate at the time to them, certainly. Have you had those run-ins with the police since you've been an adult?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But it's both the fact that we've had these interactions and the fact that the sound of a police siren, it just has a different pitch depending on what neighborhood you're in. And your heart rate speeds up in a different way when you're already anticipating the fact that this encounter could go wrong and how it could be interpreted by other people. But it's also the fact that, you know, that I, as a father now, that I know that I'm going to be forced to have conversations that other people are not going to be forced to have with our children.
So now you are going to be leaving shortly Robin Hood. You're going to go live in Baltimore. Are you going to pursue what I've called the higher calling of private equity, or are you thinking of doing something else? I've read in the newspapers that you're thinking of running for governor of Maryland. Is there any truth to that?
I am exploring running for governor of Maryland. And I'm thinking about it just in terms of, I know I want to focus on true systems change. I think we're just at a very crucial point where on issues that I have spent my entire adult life on, whether they be ending child poverty, whether it be eliminating the racial wealth gap, about how do we think about education in a fair way, that we're actually providing real pathways for our students. These are all issues that are right in front of us right now, and we're making generational decisions right now. And so I know the work, I know the issues I want to get done. I know the work I want to try to do. I'm thinking about what's the right platform. And I think that there is not just a unique potential, you know, a lane, but there's a unique way to be able to, you know, finally put an ending on issues I care about.
But suppose the president of the United States is watching this and he says, Wes, look, running for office, that's tough. Why don't you come in? I'll give you a senior job in the administration and become a cabinet officer or something. Would you go in the Biden administration, or you really want to run for office in the governorship of Maryland?
Yeah, no, I mean, I have a deep admiration for all folks who choose to serve in administrations. I also know that I'm at the stage of my career as well where I know my skill sets and I know what I'm good at. And I'm a pretty good executive. I know how to run things and run large organizations. And I work within I've worked within and with government my entire career. And I know that that for me, this is not about I want to go into politics. For me, this is about the fact that the executive role, who actually controls a budget, who has a chance to actually change a destiny for a generation of children and families, that's something that makes my heart beat faster. And that's what makes me excited.
So for people who are watching, they would say, OK, after he got his life together, he won a Rhodes Scholarship, White House Fellowship, written 5 books, heads Robin Hood, happily married, 2 kids. This is a perfect picture. Make us feel that we're not so inadequate ourselves. Tell us something you're doing that doesn't work out, where you've failed or something, so we can feel that we're just not watching a superhuman. We want to watch somebody who has, you know, mistakes or fail. There's something you can say you're not good at.
There. Let me tell you something. There is plenty that I am not good at and plenty that I've failed at. But I tell you one thing about me, David, is I'm not afraid to fail. And that's one thing that I think I've really tried to push on.
It's an incredible story. I always like to see somebody from Baltimore who's made good, and you obviously have. So thanks very much for being with us today.
And you too. Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for listening. To hear more of my interviews, you can subscribe and download my podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen.